sitting at my table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
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 Just this.
Just this.
Equality.
Equality.
Remedy. And protection.
Fairness.
Fair play.
Privacy.
Right.
Will.
Peace.
Illusions.
Mean.
Meant.
This is my mistake, and let me make it good. I raised the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
Expression.
Expression,
expression,
participation,
democracy,
welfare,
work,
work,
leisure,
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 health,
education,
focus,
culture,
human rights,
Charter Dana,
solidarity,
responsibility.
Fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on Sastel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings, and with me today is my co-host Gordon Barnes, and we're going to talk about a very important current campaign of Amnesty International, Stop Torture. Good morning, Gordon.
Morning, Jim. It's good to be on the program with you today, and welcome to everybody who's tuning in, whether you're listening here over the internet or on 91.3 FM. We welcome everybody to the program. As you were mentioning, Jim, we're going to spend most of the program talking about Amnesty International's most significant campaign over the next couple of years. That is the campaign to stop torture. But I just wanted to mention at the beginning of the program as well that people are invited to a significant upcoming event that will be happening here in Regina and around the world very soon. On Wednesday, December 10th, International Human Rights Day, we'll be participating in, along with people internationally, in Right for Rights, a global write-a-thon where people get together in communities all across Canada, but also around the world, to write appeals on behalf of people who are prisoners of conscience, people who have been victims of significant human rights abuses, and call for justice in their cases. And in Regina here, we'll be at the Artful Dodger, a well-known venue and supportive venue in Regina, on 11th Avenue, 1600 block 11th Avenue. We'll be there from 5 to 11, and the idea is you could come for the entire time or just for a portion of the evening. If you're heading out to another event in the evening, you might want to stop in right after work, whatever you like to do. And we'll have appeals ready to go and other petitions and be able to visit with people who are participating in our write-a-thon. There will be an event also the same evening in Saskatoon. There'll be, if people are tuning in from Saskatoon, there'll be meeting at the Augustana Lutheran Church starting at 7:30 in the evening, and that's on Broadway Avenue. And people are encouraged to participate from there as well. There's information about the event on our Amnesty Saskatchewan website at amnestysaskatchewan.ca, but did want to sort of mention that that's an upcoming one that's very kind of welcoming kind of environment for people who might not have participated in Amnesty International before. If you'd like to learn more about letter writing, be a great opportunity. So, as we mentioned, the program today, the sort of focus is on our most significant campaign that's happening around the world over the next couple of years. And it's something that Amnesty International has actually worked on for over 50 years now, and that is the campaign to stop torture. But we're really needing to bring about a significant more pressure relative to that issue. And while we've seen some significant successes on individual cases and some systemic changes, there are concerns that actually the progress that's been made is being eroded. We've campaigned in support of the Convention Against Torture, which was adopted by the United Nations in 1984 and has now been signed by 155 countries, or 81% of the United Nations member states. However, as we say, three decades after we thought we had turned the tide on torture, the practice is still flourishing as more governments seek to justify it now in the name of national security. And currently, Amnesty International is reporting that torture and other forms of ill treatment have happened in at least 141 countries from every region of the world over the last 5 years. And really, it's the secret of nature of torture that means the true number of countries that torture is likely higher. Our approach is that once we know about it, and that's the purpose of sharing information today, we need to work together to stop it, and that we believe that by sharing the information, we can contribute to stopping torture. It's when things happen in secret that countries continue to think they can get away with it. And I think, Jim, as part of the sort of introduction to the program, you were going to share a little bit of history in terms of recent history in Canada with a very significant case that some people will recall but maybe is worth refreshing our memory about, and that's with regard to Mahar Arar. And Jim, if you wanted to take a little bit of time and share that.
It's really astonishing what happened, and it really goes back 12 years, amazingly enough. And Mahar Arar, in September 26th of 2002, he's getting aboard an American Airlines flight from Zurich to JFK Airport in New York, en route to Montreal. He arrives in New York at 2 in the afternoon and lines up at the immigration counter. When his name is entered into the computer, he is pulled aside. 2 hours later, he's fingerprinted and photographed. He is told this is regular procedure. Airport police search his bag and wallet and photocopy his passport. They refuse to answer Arar's questions and will not let him make a phone call. You think about it, Greg, that would kind of make you worried.
Yeah,
at that point.
For sure.
But it's always fun going through customs, as we all know. Anyway, officials from the New York Police Department and the Federal Bureau of Investigations say they will question him and then let him catch his connecting flight to Montreal. Arar asks for a lawyer and is told he has no right to a lawyer because he is not an American citizen. that's scary. So when you and I are in the States, we've got no rights. I wonder about that one. An intense interrogation continues until midnight. Arar is questioned about his work, his salary, his travel in the U.S., and about different people. He's questioned in particular about Abdullah Amalki. Arar tells them that he only knows him very casually, but that he worked with his brother Nasra at two high-tech firms in Ottawa and Hull. He tells them that the Amalki family came from Syria about the same time as his, so the families know of each other. Arar does not know why they are questioning him so much about Abdullah. He tells them he has seen Abdullah a few times, and he describes in detail the times he can remember. Arar is shocked when they show him the rental lease he signed when he moved to Ottawa in 1997. So we're talking 5 years previous. It was witnessed by Abdullah Amalki. Arar remembers this and explains he had asked Nasir to sign it, but Nasir was busy and sent his brother instead. Arar describes the questioning as intense and says he was pressured to answer all questions quickly. He says they were humiliating and rude. He tells them he has nothing to hide and tells them everything he knows. He asks repeatedly for a lawyer, but the request is ignored. Arar's wrists and ankles are chained, and he's taken in a van to a nearby building where others are being held and put in a cell. September 27, 2002, at 9 a.m., Marar is taken for more questioning. He has not eaten or slept since he was on the flight from Zurich. He is interrogated for 8 hours and is asked many questions, including what he thinks about bin Laden. Now, keep in mind, Gord, we're not talking about a foreign country here. We're talking about the States.
Mm.
You know, this isn't going to some third world nation where you're worried about the illegal tactics, or I guess if you're in some of these countries, legal is whatever they decide it's going to be.
That's right.
And you expect, I think, a different treatment when you're in a so-called civilized country like the United States.
Yeah.
Where am I here? Okay. He asked repeatedly for a lawyer, but the request is ignored. And on September 27th, 9 o'clock, more questioning. He's interrogated for 8 hours and is asked many questions, including what he thinks about bin Laden, Palestine, and Iraq. He's also asked about the mosques he prays in, his bank accounts, his mail addresses, and his relatives. An INS official informs him they would like him to voluntarily return to Syria. Arar says no, he would like to return to Canada. He asks again for a lawyer and is refused. Arar is asked to sign an immigration form, but they do not show him the contents. Arar, exhausted, signs the form. At about 8 p.m., he's shackled and put in a van and driven to the Metropolitan Detention Center. Arar continues to ask why this is happening, and they continue to refuse to answer him or tell him where he's being taken. He is strip-searched and asked to sign more forms for a doctor and vaccinated. He asks what the vaccine is, but they will not tell him. Arar continues to ask for a lawyer and a phone call and is ignored. September 28th to October 7th, 2002, Arar is not able to sleep until early in the morning and wakes up at 11 a.m. on September 28th. This is the first time he has slept since leaving Zurich 2 days earlier. Arar notices he's being treated differently than other prisoners at the MDC. For example, guards will not give him toothpaste or a toothbrush or newspapers. On the second or third day at the MDC, that's the Metropolitan Detention Center, Arar is given a document saying that he is inadmissible to the United States under Section 235C of the Immigration and Nationality Act because he is not a citizen of the United States. He is a native of Syria and is a citizen of Syria and Canada. He arrived in the United States on September 26, 2002 and applied for admission as a non-immigrant in transit through the United States destined to Canada. And he is a member of an organization that has been designated by the Secretary of State as a foreign terrorist organization to wit, Al-Qaeda, a.k.a. Al-Qaeda, while it's kind of spelled differently, it looks the same. Arar continues to ask for a lawyer and phone call, and his requests are denied until October 2nd, when he is permitted to make a two-minute telephone call to his mother-in-law in Ottawa. He tells her he is frightened and he might be deported to Syria and asks her to get him a lawyer. On October 3 or 4, Arar is asked to fill out a form asking where he would like to be deported to. He writes that he chooses to be sent to Canada and that he has no concerns about going there. He signs the document. On October 4, Arar receives a visit from Canadian consul Maureen Gervin. Arar shows her the document he has been given, and she notes the contents. He tells her he is frightened of being deported to Syria, and she reassures him that this will not happen. On October 5th, Arar is visited by lawyer Amal Umeh. They talk for 30 minutes, and he relates his fears to her and asks her to help. She advises him not to sign anything without her being present. On October 6, 2002, 9 p.m. on Sunday night, guards come to take Arar from his cell, saying that his attorney is there to see him. Arar is taken to a room where about seven officials are waiting. His attorney is not there. He is told that they contacted his attorney and that he refused to come. This is strange because Arar's lawyer is a woman. They ask why Arar does not want to go to Syria, and Arar tells them he is afraid he will be tortured there. He says he did not do his military service before leaving Syria. He is a Sunni Muslim, and his mother's cousin was accused of being part of the Muslim Brotherhood and imprisoned. They ask him to sign a document, and he refuses. This session continues until 3 a.m. when he is taken back to his cell. On October 8, 2002, Arar is wakened at 3 a.m. and told he's leaving. He's given food and then taken from his cell. A woman reads to him from a document, saying that based on classified information that they could not reveal to him, and because he knows a number of men, including Abdullah al-Malki, Naza al-Malki, and Ahmed Abu el-Mati, the INS director has decided to deport him to Syria. Arar protests, saying he'll be tortured there. He is ignored. He is chained and taken to a waiting car and driven to an airport in New Jersey. Arar is placed on a private jet. He is the only passenger. They fly to Washington and the people with him disembark, and a new team gets on the plane. Arar overhears the men talking on the phone saying that Syria is refusing to take him directly, but Jordan will take him. They fly to Portland, to Rome, and then to Amman, Jordan. On the trip to Amman, Arar is given a sweater and jeans to wear. He does not know then that he will wear these clothes until the end of December. October 9, 2002, the jet lands in Amman, Jordan, at 3 a.m. There are six or seven Jordanians waiting for him. Arar is blindfolded and chained and put into a van. He is forced to bend his head down in the back seat. He is beaten intensely every time he tries to move or talk. 30 minutes later, they arrive at a building where they remove his blindfold and ask him routine questions before taking him to a cell. In the afternoon, they take his fingerprints and photographs, and he is blindfolded and put in another van. He is told he is going back to Montreal. About 45 minutes later, they stop, and he is put in a different car. He is forced to keep his head down, and he is beaten again. Over an hour later, they arrive at what Arar believes was the Syrian border. He is handed over to a new team of men and put in a new car, which travels for another 3 hours to Damascus. At about 6 p.m., he is taken into a building which he later finds out is the Far Falestin, or the Palestinian branch of the Syrian military intelligence. He is taken into a room for interrogation. There are three men in the room. Arar later learns that one of the men is a colonel. They put him on a chair, and the colonel begins the interrogation. Arar is asked about his family and why they left Syria. Arar answers the questions but is threatened with a metal chair in the corner. He later learns that this chair is used to torture people. Arar decides he'll confess to anything they want in order to stop the torture. The interrogation lasts for 4 hours without any violence. Only the threat of violence is used. In October 10, 2002, early in the morning on October 10th, Arar is taken downstairs to a basement. The guard opens the door and Arar sees for the first time the cell he will live in for the following 10 months and 10 days. Arar calls the cell a grave. It is 3 feet wide, 6 feet deep, and 7 feet high. It has a metal door with a small opening which does not let in light because of a piece of metal on the outside for sliding things into the cell. There is a 1-by-2-foot opening in the ceiling with iron bars. This opening is below another ceiling and lets in just a tiny shaft of light. Cats urinate through the ceiling traps of these cells, often onto the prisoners. Rats wander there too. There is no light source in the cell. The only things in the cell are 2 blankets, 2 plastic bowls, and 2 bottles. Arar later uses 2 small empty boxes, one as a toilet when he is not allowed to the washroom, and 1 for prayer water. October 11th to the 16th, 2002, early the next morning, Arar is taken upstairs for an intense interrogation. He is beaten on his palms, wrists, lower back, and hips with a shredded black electrical cable, which is about 2 inches in diameter. He is threatened with the metal chair, electric shocks, and with the tire into which prisoners are stuffed, immobilized, and beaten. The next day, Arar is interrogated and beaten on and off for 18 hours. Arar begs them to stop. He is asked if he received military training in Afghanistan, and he falsely confesses and says yes. This is the first time Arar is ever questioned about Afghanistan. They ask at which camp and provide him with a list, and he picks one of the camps listed. Arar urinated on himself 2 times during the interrogation. Throughout this period of intense interrogation, Arar was not taken back to his cell, but to a waiting room where he could hear other prisoners being tortured and screaming. One time he heard them repeatedly slam a man's head on a desk really hard. From October 17th to the 22nd, during the second week of the interrogation, Arar is forced into a car tire, so he is immobilized. This was used to scare him, but he is not beaten while in the tire, as with other prisoners. The intensity of the beating and interrogation subsides after October 17th. Interrogators start using a new tactic, taking Arar into a room blindfolded so he can hear people talking about him, saying he knows lots of people who are terrorists. We will get their numbers. He is a liar. He has been out of the country. They occasionally slap him on the face. October 23rd, Arar is taken from his cell and his beard is shaved. He is taken to another building where his interrogators and other investigators are waiting for him. They seem nervous. Arar is warned not to say he has been beaten and is then taken into a room where he meets with a Canadian consul. He is accompanied by his interrogator, a colonel, and 2 other Syrian officials at all times. The meeting lasts for 10 minutes, and Arar cries throughout. October 29th, Arar receives his 2nd visit from Canadian consul. He is again accompanied by Syrian officials and his interrogator throughout the meeting. In early November 2002, Arar is taken up from his cell to sign and place his thumbprint on every page of a handwritten document about 7 pages long. He is not allowed to read it. He's shown another document about 3 pages long with questions. Who are your friends? How long have you been out of the country? The last question is followed by empty lines. The first questions were already answered by his captors, but Arar is made to answer the last in his own handwriting as they dictate to him. He is told to write that he has been to Afghanistan. He is forced to sign and place his thumbprint on the last page of that document. On November 12th, 2002, Arar receives his third visit from Canadian consul. He is again accompanied by Syrian officials and his interrogator throughout the meeting. Arar asks for money so he can purchase clothing and supplies. After the meeting, his captors are angry that he made that request, but he is not beaten. December 10th, Arar receives his fourth visit from the Canadian consul. He is again accompanied by Syrian officials and his interrogator throughout the meeting. The consul delivers money, and 2 weeks after the meeting, Arar is able to get new clothes and arrange for the first time and change for the first time since the flight from the U.S. So all this time he's been in the clothes that he was given months ago. In December 2002, sometime in December, Arar experiences a nervous crisis. His mind is crowded with memories and he loses control and starts screaming. This happens 3 times. The second time, a guard notices and takes him to wash his face. In January 7th, Arar receives his fifth visit from Canadian consul. He's again accompanied by Syrian officials and his interrogator throughout the meeting. On February 8th, his sixth visit from the Canadian consul. He's again accompanied by Syrian officials and his interrogator throughout the meeting. During the visit, the Syrian officials question why these visits are necessary, saying they will take care of Arar. In early April, Arar is taken from his cell and placed in an outdoor court. This is the first time he's seen sunlight in 6 months. April 23, 2003, Arar is taken from his cell and his beard is shaved. He is told to comb his hair and wash his face well. He is taken outside, put in a car, and driven to another building. He is taken into the building and given tea. The Syrian officials seem very agitated and nervous. Arar is taken into a room to meet with the Canadian ambassador to Syria and MPs Marlene Catterall and Sarkis Azaburian. He is accompanied by his interrogator and other Syrian officials throughout the meeting. After he is taken from the room, he overhears officials talking about media coverage of his case. June 2003, Arar is taken outside into the sunshine twice in June. He asks to meet with an investigator and his request is eventually granted. He asks to be moved to a cell fit for human beings. The Syrian official responds they are very busy because of the situation in Iraq and orders him back to his cell. July 2003, Arar asks again for a meeting with an investigator and his request is eventually granted. He tells him he has nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. The Syrian official asks Arar why he is accused of this, why they sent a delegation and why these people hate him so much. Arar says he does not know. Arar notices his skin is turning yellow and feels he is at the brink of a nervous breakdown. Again in July of 2003, Arar is taken from his cell and questioned about William Sampson. He does not know who this is and says he does not. After the questioning, Arar wonders if this is a journalist. August 14, 2003, Arar receives his seventh visit from the Canadian consul. He is again accompanied by Syrian officials and his interrogator, and the head Syrian military intelligence is also there. Arar has decided he cannot survive living in these conditions anymore, and that it is worth risking more physical torture to stop the ongoing psychological torture of remaining in the grave. He bursts and tells the Canadian consul in English, in front of the Syrian officials, about his cell and the conditions he is living in. The consul asks if he has been tortured, and Arar replies, yes, of course, at the beginning. After the meeting, Arar can see that his captors are very angry, and he is terrified that he will be physically tortured again, but he is not. August 19, 2003, Arar is taken upstairs and made to sit on the floor. He is given a piece of paper to write on. He is told to write, among other things, that he went to a training camp in Afghanistan. The official kicks him every time he objects. He also threatens to put Arar in the tire. Arar is forced to sign and put his thumbprint on the last page. Arar is then taken to the investigation branch and placed in a collective cell, which is about 6 by 4 meters in size. There are 46 people crammed into the space. The door is difficult to open because of the crowding. The prisoners ask him who he is and where he has been, and they are shocked to learn he has been in the grave for so long. Arar spends that night there. August 20th, 2003, Arar is blindfolded, put in a vehicle, and driven to Sadneya prison. Once again, Syrian officials will not tell him where he's going. He has heard from the other prisoners at the investigation branch that prisoners are tortured when they arrive there, so he tells officials there he had been recently visited by a Canadian consular official. This seems to have an impact. Arar is not tortured when he arrives at Sadneya prison. He's placed in a collective cell and is able to talk with other prisoners and move around. Arar says this was like heaven compared to where he was at the Palestine branch. September 19 or 20, 2003, Arar is teaching English to some other prisoners in his cell when he hears others saying that another Canadian has arrived. He looks up and sees a thin man with a shaved head looking very weak. After some time, he realizes this is Abdullah Al-Malki. Al-Malki tells Arar he has also been at the Palestine branch and that he was in a cell like Arar's for even longer. He tells Arar he has been severely tortured with the tire and the cable. He says he was also hung upside down. Al-Malki also says he was tortured at Sadneya prison just weeks before. September 28th to October 4th, 2003, Arar is called from his cell and told to collect his things. He's blindfolded, put in a van, and driven back to the Palestine branch. He's put in one of the interrogation waiting rooms and kept there for 7 days. The entire time he is there, he hears prisoners being tortured and screaming. Arar is devastated and does not know what is happening to him. At 9 p.m. on Saturday, October 4th, he is told that he will be going to Canada. Arar does not believe this. October 5th of 2003, on Sunday morning, Arar is told by the colonel to wash his face. The colonel seems very unhappy. They put chains on his wrists and legs and put him in a car. He is driven to a court. Arar still does not believe he is going to Canada. He is taken to meet with a prosecutor and asks again for a lawyer. He is told he will not need one. The prosecutor reads from Arar's confession and Arar tries to protest, saying he was beaten and forced to say he went to Afghanistan. The prosecutor ignores him and tells him he must sign and put his fingerprint on the document. Arar does as he is told. Arar is not permitted to see the document. The prosecutor does not lay out any charges and tells him that he will be released. Arar is taken outside and put in a car and driven back to the Palestine branch, where he meets with the head of the Syrian military intelligence and officials from the Canadian embassy. Arar believes at last that he is being released. The colonel escorts them out of the building into a waiting embassy car. Arar is driven to the Canadian embassy and later taken to the Canadian consul's home for a shower before taking his flight out of Syria. Wow.
It's an amazing story, and maybe we can come back to it, Jim. I appreciate the
sharing of it.
We're overdue on a break, I guess, a station break. So
we'll
if you want to go there, and then we can continue with the discussion about Arar's story after the break.
That was an amazing story.
It is. And, you know, this is somebody that later, because of the failure of the Canadian government to adequately provide support to him, was compensated by the government of Canada. And Prime Minister Harper made an apology to Mahar Arar. I had the opportunity to hear Arar speak when he came through Saskatchewan a few years ago, and he told his story much as you've shared it today, Jim. He spoke at the Saskatchewan branch of the Canadian Bar Association, very well attended, and I can tell you that everybody was listening with great concern about his experience. I should mention as well that a few years ago at a Amnesty International Canada annual meeting, I had an opportunity to meet his wife, who spoke about the experience she went through when Maharajar was in jail. She was a tireless campaigner on his behalf, trying to get the attention of the Canadian public and also the Government of Canada. And as I say, it was a long time before they took an interest in his case. And in fact, the evidence showed that for quite a significant period, they were contributing to the situation he was in Syria. And the sad thing now is that despite, you know, the record having been cleared, he has never yet received an apology from the United States government. There is a call, an appeal being made to President Obama that the American government really needs to apologize to Maharajar. But that's part of the process where, you know, these things continue on. And I think probably it's worth us moving on from that and just sharing one of the campaign videos that and some of the messages about this particular campaign that Amnesty International's campaign put together.
And I'm just going to add, Gord, that anybody that wants to kind of do their own research on this and look up torture and amnesty, and you'll find lots of stories that are out there, and they're so heartrending, and the thing is, what makes it so hard to believe is that so-called civilized countries are doing this. Mm-hmm. And you know, like the United States has not apologized. The Canadian government basically has, and I think there was a monetary settlement.
That's right.
And so there was some compensation there, and I'm sure, given the choice, that Mr. Arar would rather it had never happened, and he would gladly give up the money. I think it was about $1 million or something like that that he was provided. But he went through a terrible, terrible thing there. But anyway, let's go to this video and keep in mind that there's going to be stuff on it that you can't see, but the audio is well worth listening to. I'm just going to fire it up here, and this has been one of those technically challenging days here. So, but this should come up for us here without too much difficulty.
It was late at night. I was about to take a shower, so the doorbell rang. My mom called me. I got out of the bathroom, and there were two guns pointed in my face. So the guards took me to Evin prison. I was only 16 years old. They first handcuffed me, and then they tied me to a bare wooden bed. Very securely. I couldn't budge on my stomach. They took off my socks and my shoes, and then they lashed the soles of my feet with a length of cable. They use full force. So the pain is impossible to describe. It is beyond anything. Amnesty International has long fought on behalf of people like me who've been tortured, helping to ensure that we are protected and freed. Now, Amnesty is running a campaign to stop torture everywhere and forever. Children, sons, daughters, fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, grandfathers, and grandmothers. These people have all been tortured.
I was detained immediately at the airport, and I was sent to a place internationally infamous. It's called Farah Palestine. I was told that on that first day, I was whipped for more than 1,000 times. I was tortured for 7-8 hours. You know, they destroyed my life. Not only my life, my family. This has affected my parents, affected my brothers, affected greatly my wife, affected my kids. Some of my kids, we had to take them to, they had to be treated. It left me with a lot of not only psychological and cognitive challenges, but also a lot of physical pains, which are permanent, and just with time just becoming worse and worse. No one should go through what I went through. What if it was your family member who was tortured? It's unimaginable, isn't it?
I was taken into underground facility, tortured for 31 days. Till now, I don't know the reason that I why I was tortured. I was electrocuted a few times, actually 4 times as I remember. 2 times I had to wake up in hospital unconscious. Together with Amnesty International, you and I can help fight to stop torture everywhere and forever.
Amnesty International has found evidence that torture continues to flourish in more than 141 countries over the past 5 years. Join us by speaking out to end torture. Together with you, we are fighting to ensure that there are safeguards that protect people around the world from being tortured. Join us to call on governments to reveal the secret locations where torture is committed, to enact mechanisms to prevent abuse and punish torturers, to allow proper medical examinations, prompt access to lawyers, independent checks on detention facilities, investigations into torture allegations, the prosecution of suspects, and proper redress for victims. There is so much we can do together. Join us to stand between the torturer and the victim. Together, we will work towards our goal to stop torture everywhere and forever.
And of course, that last speaker there was Alex Neve, who is the Secretary General of Amnesty International, the Canadian English speaking section. And you know, it's hard to believe that this exists, and it's clear that an attitude change has to happen, you know, at the government level, and we have to do something here in our own country, because I think our own government tends to sort of stand back and whatever their partner, the United States, deems is necessary, well, that's probably okay. Unless the public finds out about it and is outraged, as they were with Mr. Arar.
That's right, Jim. And, you know, there's another country that we wanted to spend a bit of time on where torture is rampant, and Canada and Canadians could have a very significant influence on, and that is Mexico. It's documented that torture and other ill treatment has been rampant in Mexico for over 50 years. And in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, there was a widespread and systemic use of torture in what was called the Dirty War against suspected armed opposition groups and perceived political opponents. And more recently, since 2006, this is just amazing, since 2006, an estimated 80,000 people have been killed in Mexico in organized crime-related violence. And in 2012, the UN Committee on Against Torture noted there have been reports of an alarming increase in the use of torture during interrogation of persons who have been arbitrarily detained by members of Mexico's armed forces or state security. And, you know, just a tragic bit of news from Mexico over the last month or so. People may be aware of this, and if not, it's been fairly widely reported, but not enough, I think. 43 students were disappeared in Mexico. They were on a school bus, stopped, and in a particular area of Mexico there, the issues around violence that involve both the cartels but also the police are rampant. And earlier last week, the mayor and his wife, who had of that particular region, who had gone into hiding themselves, have now been arrested and are thought to be responsible for these students' disappearance. a week ago, if you can imagine, the Attorney General of Mexico met with the families of the disappeared students and has indicated that after investigation, they believe that the students have all been tortured, have been killed, their bodies have been burned, and this is just a tragic outcome. The families are not prepared at this point to believe this is what's happened. They're still calling for further investigations into the circumstances of the disappearance of the students. The Attorney General of Mexico is stating that the bodies were so badly burned that it's not possible to confirm what's happened relative to DNA evidence. And this, you know, this is a country that Canada has significant relationships with, that our own government could bring significant international pressure on them. And Canadians visit regularly for travel and business. And, you know, we need to be very, very mindful of what's going on in that country when we're thinking about visiting there. We've had some, you might say, success recently relative to one particular prisoner case. Alex Neve, who you referenced, Jim, and some other members of the Canadian section were able to go to Mexico about middle of September. And Alex actually met with one person who was in jail at the time, who had been tortured. His name was Angel Colon, and he was a member of the African community in Honduras. He had been detained in Baja, California State, Mexico, and he was interrogated and tortured and held in prison for a significant length of time. Fortunately, as a result of the international pressure, he has been released. But, you know, the scale of what's happened to him and so many people in Mexico relative to the issues around torture is just appalling. And we need to be very, very focused in terms of our work, our and energy around raising concerns with respect to what's going on in that particular country. There are other cases as well that Amnesty's highlighting as part of our campaign in Mexico, and we'd encourage people to take a few minutes and visit the amnesty.ca website. There's a particular section of it that focuses on the Stop Torture campaign, and as I say, the extent to which we all know about this and are aware this is happening brings some responsibility for all of us to spend some time and calling for an end to torture, addressing some of the systemic issues, but also supporting appeals for individuals who Amnesty is working on behalf of. And that's really one of the things that we'll do on December 10th, International Human Rights Day. People, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, will be meeting here in Regina at the Artful Dodger in the evening, and it's part of the Global Write-a-thon. People can, if you've never participated in an Amnesty International event, feel very welcome to join us in the evening. And, you know, participate in letter writing, because really it's a very simple process. Who I know who has a lot of experience with respect to this relative to having gone through a horrible situation in Argentina has said, you know, the only letter that will never work when you're writing an appeal is the one you never wrote or sent. And I really think that's a significant kind of comment. We need to join together, not only on December 10th, but continuously to bring about an awareness of these issues,
such a fundamental human rights abuses that are happening in Mexico and in Arar's case in Syria, with the conflict in Iraq right now. It has been widely reported about the torture that's people are being subject to by ISIS, and Nigeria is another example, the Philippines, and those are countries where the Canadian section of Amnesty International is really trying to raise awareness, but it's not exclusive to those countries. So, Jim, I'm not sure how we're doing in terms of keeping track of time here, and are we getting close to the end of the hour there?
We are. We've got about 3 minutes, and I was just going to add, Gord, that one of the really good things about the letter writing, the urgent actions that we respond to, are the documentation that we get is very educational. And you really get very well briefed about why the letters are being written, what the situation is there. So that alone is worth the effort, I think.
That's right. And, it's been very interesting over the years personally to be involved in that process. Amnesty International does believe that in well over a third of the cases that we're involved with, there's been a situation where people have been released or their situation's improved. So that does indicate that there's some progress being made, but we need to continue on with our human rights work.
And on that, I think we'll close this week's Human Rights Radio, Gord, on CJTR Community Radio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For information on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, founder of Amnesty International, said, "Only when the last prisoner of conscience has been freed, the last torture chamber has been closed, the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a reality for the world's people, will our work be done."